Duval schools take the city to court. JEA could soon be on the market, and the vice president is in town again, this time with Ivanka Trump. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, it's all the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can get on the line and join us. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, former tenants at the Jacksonville Landing are finding new digs. We'll see where they've headed. That's coming up. But first this hour, it's Friday, and here to discuss a very busy week in the news, we welcome Emily Block of the Florida Times-Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record is here.
Good morning, Melissa.
Stephanie Brown of WOKV.
Thank you for having me.
And regular contributor Charles Griggs.
Good morning, Melissa.
So good to have all four of you here. Lots to talk about this week. Everything from a vice presidential visit to more wrangling when it comes to the city versus Duval County Public Schools. That's all coming up. But our top story this morning, the JEA board voted Tuesday to look at a path to privatize the publicly owned energy and water utility. CEO Aaron Zahn now has the authority to look at different ways of selling or privatizing JEA, everything from becoming a privately held or investor-owned company like Florida Power and Light, evaluating an IPO, or converting into a customer-owned utility. There has been so much discussion about this controversial move that we're going to begin the hour with a closer look, and we want your calls. Where do you stand on the notion of privatizing JEA? For or against? What are your thoughts about all this? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. Mike Mendenhall, let's begin with you. This was not really unexpected, but at the same time, people are fired up again about this because this isn't the first time the utility has gone down this path. What did the board say to justify opening the door to privatization?
So the justification for it is that there the revenue is declining, sales are declining at JEA, particularly on the energy side. The idea is that as renewable energy becomes more affordable, storage of renewable energy becomes affordable for both commercial and residential consumers, that slip will continue. And so the argument is that a move toward privatization would allow them to expand into other areas of business that would current state, local, and statutes just don't allow.
Okay. Stephanie Brown, the CEO of the company, Aaron Zahn, presented the board with what critics say is a false choice. Either we privatize right away or we have to lay off hundreds of JEA workers right away. What about that?
Well, any decision is at least a year away is the first thing that we do have to consider, because this board's vote authorized them to really research, solicit offers for privatization or community ownership. But ultimately, it's going to come back to the board at the end of that process. And Zahn told me after the meeting that one of the options that will still be on the table is that more traditional response, which involves the layoffs and rate hikes for customers. Now, when we get a year down the road and they are faced with privatization or the layoffs, that's when, you know, it is obviously a very severe choice. What I think will be interesting is over the next year, if some of those critics are able to come up with maybe even a third option or path, because ultimately, if those are the only two options on the table, then one will need to be chosen. So what is that other option that could be considered?
Right. Yeah. Charles Griggs.
Yeah. So the history of this is that what's been put on the table is that JEA would not look at privatization. We've seen what happened last year when they were looking to approach this scenario, and the public, you know, pushed back on that all the way to the point where council took action to say that they would have to go through council for more than 10%, you know, sale was more than 10% of the utility. And now you're coming back and saying that, well, that wasn't really the case. The scenario has changed, and now we're going to put privatization back on the table. That's a heavy lift for the public to accept. And the JEA not only is going to have to convince the board, employees, but the public, as well as city council members, that this is a move that is going to be in the best interest of the community.
Right. The pressure will mount on members of the city council, Emily Block, both from City Hall, the mayor's office, and the public. They're going to get squeezed on this because there is strong public opposition to selling off this utility, even if the mayor and others could conceivably make the case for why this would be beneficial to the city's coffers.
Absolutely. And what we're hearing from the public is more so a why is there this shadiness, this pay no attention to the man behind the curtain sort of thing, where they're saying, no, privatization is not on the table. And then they turn around and say, well, actually, we're considering it. And that goes on to the media as well. My colleague Chris Hong has been covering this story and was denied an interview with Aaron Zahn, saying that he only wanted to speak to a specific reporter. So that's not being fully transparent.
The transparency issue, I think, is what has not sat well with the public, Mike. In particular, the narrative that's taken hold, which is that this is something that the mayor wants, although he hasn't come out publicly and said so. One of his first acts when he became mayor was to purge the city's boards and commissions of the people that were serving out those terms and put in loyalists, including on the JEA board. And so whether or not it's true, a narrative seems to have that the fix has been put in for this some time ago. And so what about that? Is that going to be a political issue for JEA and the fourth floor at City Hall if they are intent on really getting this accomplished?
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely going to have to try to make the case that this is not only to the benefit of JEA employees, but also their customers as well. Although Mayor Curry didn't come out in full support of the measure the other day, he did make a statement and said that he wouldn't support an option that had mass layoffs. So, I mean, there is this stage setting already, like to push the issue of privatization further. And I think too, because the way that it was rolled out, it was the strategic planning process that they went into they started with, you know, with we need to increase rates and reduce our city contribution to, you know, we need to lay off a lot of people to, well, here is, you know, the best alternative. It was almost a bit of theatrics.
And Stephanie, JEA gives the city over $100 million a year. And so the people arguing JEA is ours, don't sell it off. They're saying don't kill the goose that laid the golden egg. The city would lose that annual contribution. On the other hand, they'd get a windfall of billions of dollars if JEA were sold to, say, Florida Power and Light or some other actor. They could put that money into a lot of pressing needs for the city. JEA also doesn't contribute to the school coffers. That's been another argument that has been made about why this could be a good thing.
And when you talk about the question of privatization, I think it is important to talk about what that actually means, because it's this broad concept. But as you just mentioned, there are annual implications on the city's budget. There are concerns about in a disaster response, a private entity isn't going to be available for the same FEMA reimbursements, as an example. Now, the proposal on the table, while we don't know what exactly the path toward potential privatization would look like, JEA did put together some what they call minimum requirements. So that $3 billion at least contribution upfront cash offer is what Zahn told me. And so that could be something that, again, addresses a lot of immediate needs, but you're balancing it against a long-term annual contribution. And we know the charter in place right now actually goes for several more years, but then, of course, would have to be renegotiated, and you don't know what those terms would look like.
Let's go to lots of calls as we ask you, the public, where do you stand on renewed talk about privatizing JEA? The board has moved forward with this, and the CEO of JEA. They've also reached out to financial players to do the paperwork and the heavy lifting. It's 549-2937. Joe is in St. John's. Hi, Joe. Good morning.
Good morning. Okay, I've got a couple of points. Okay, first point, okay, a transaction like this, multi-billion dollars, there's going to be a couple hundred million dollars of fees and commissions. They're going to get paid. Who's getting those? I mean, and who is going to get a little side benefit or get to dip their beak? Number two is that if this management group cannot manage the JEA effectively and efficiently and work to secure lower energy prices for the future of Jacksonville, put them out. They're not, you know, if they're intent on, you know, privatization, they're not going to do that. We don't need that. Okay, and three, okay, if they did do it and they had this huge billions of dollars of money to do things for the city, okay, what a huge political slush fund. I mean, really?
Hmm. Yeah, okay, Joe.
That would just be people buying votes. Anyway, thank you.
Thanks, Joe. His comments, Charles, I think reflect the cynicism and the suspicion a lot of voters out there have about this.
Yeah, people who I've spoken with really don't trust the process. They don't understand why all of a sudden when we were told one thing, now something else comes into play. And not only that, but you have to explain, you have to be very diligent in explaining how all of the money is going to be appropriated and spent. The minimum of $3 billion, even though that's what the minimum sale price would go for, it wouldn't mean that the city would get all that money back because, you know, there are other things that would come into play. And then, you know, of course, you've got other incentives and things like that they're trying to move in terms of customer rebates and so forth to make the pot sweeter for to sell this to the community. But at the same time, the city council, I'm going to go back to that now. You've got members on here who are just elected. Newly elected, and they've got to come up again in 4 years, and you've got members who are, termed out, so to speak. They have to make the case to these people and help them understand why all of a sudden the change and where we were a year ago.
Mark in Mayport. Hi, Mark. Thanks for holding. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Melissa. Good Friday to you.
You too.
Hey, I just think selling JEA seems, to use an old phrase, penny wise and pound foolish. I mean, we get the money up front. We pay off some of our debt, do some nice things, and then 10 years down the road, we're back in the same boat. And it just seems like you had a caller earlier this week said, follow the money, follow the money. That's what I think. They also did away with net metering in the dark of night. There's an attack on renewable energy. Something's going on here.
Okay, thanks for that, Mark. Here's another point of view from a listener. Joe emails the show. Why demonize JEA becoming a publicly traded investor-owned company? More than 85% of America receives power this way. I've had FPL and had better service and better rates than my current JEA, and FPL was superior in hurricane recovery, he says. Okay, so let's go to a few more calls. Lots of calls. Everyone is really wanting to get their point of view in. Daniel is in Riverside. Hi, Daniel. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I just wanted to say that I don't support the sale of JEA, partly because the majority of Jacksonville has said that they don't support it. I don't think it's a good idea. The idea that we want to give away $120 million in a contribution to our annual budget, frankly, doesn't make a lot of financial sense. And I just want to point out the irony of the fact that the JEA board and the executives are saying that the utility is not in good financial health when a year ago they were saying that it was, up to the point that they wanted to pay down debt earlier because they had much more cash flow. So the argument is kind of false when they say they need to lay off employees because they don't have the financial health in order to maintain the structure and the utility as it is, because they've said opposite opinions not more than 11 or 12 months before this date.
Okay, thanks for that, Daniel. Stephanie.
So the concern here is not the immediate financial health. JEA is looking 10 years into the future, and that's where you start to get Plant Vogtle obligations that come down, and you start to really see the impact of the declining revenue that is affecting us now, but not to the degree that it will a few more years down the road. So some of those steps that they've been taking, like paying back debt, is to try to mitigate some of that. But now they're at the point where they say, I mean, we could do status quo and ultimately be hit with the reality a few years down the road, or we can look ahead and say, how do we deal with this reality? So it's just important to emphasize that while the effects, the layoffs, for example, would happen almost immediately within a few months, if that's the path they go down, it's designed to deal with what would happen a few years down the road.
You know, all of this has made me wonder, Mike Mendenhall, how other comparable utilities around the country are dealing with these pressures in the energy industry. Here in the Southeast, for example, other cities roughly the same size as Jacksonville have publicly owned utilities. How are they doing? They aren't pushing this mad rush to privatization, which makes me kind of question the speed with which this is being moved along.
Yeah, so you know, JEA's position, the leadership will tell you that they're at the forefront, that this is that they're trying something that no other municipal utility is trying, because they're trying to react to these market trends. But before they have a profound effect, in my research yesterday, I found that there's a publicly owned utility in South Carolina that's actually trying a similar situation, but they're actually in much more financial trouble. And to one of the caller's points about renewable energy, the JEA actually did put into their guarantees, actually, a renewable energy component. They've promised that they would provide 100% renewable energy to both the city and the Duval County school districts. I believe it was by 2025 or 2030.
26? I think it was 26. Yeah.
So they are trying to address that as well.
Bruce and Yuli. Hi, Bruce. Thanks for holding. You're on the air. Hey, Bruce. Go ahead and turn your phone down and go ahead and talk. Bruce, are you there? I was hoping to get him on. He said he used to work at JEA. Okay, Bruce, just give us a call back, all right? Let's take one more call and then we'll move on. Linda is in Mandarin. Hi, Linda. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I just want to do a mini history. I'm confused because my whole life, which has been over 20 years in Jacksonville, we had the lowest rates, the best run utility, and that was not called into question until the end of this last CEO's tenure, and now we have a new, less experienced CEO. I have no idea of the experience of the board to be able to evaluate this, and now all of a sudden, we're upside down. We have to privatize right away, lay off 500 people, which truth is true in that short span of time. Were we never that efficient, and that was covered up, or is Mr. Zahn, or whatever his name is, I mean, which fact is true, and have we done a deep dive to get the books to know? Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Charles? Yes.
So this is, again, one of those cases where the JEA is going to have to figure out a way to educate the community on what they believe is their scenario because of the shortness of time, because of the brevity of this proposal. I mean, you know, last month it was, we're going to let go 500 people. We're going to kind of investigate, figure out what's the best scenario to get us out of this. And then the very next month, you got, you know, so like the nuclear scenario where we're going to, you know, privatize. It's going to take a lot for them to convince people that this is a futuristic move on their behalf. And they're looking, they're forward thinking, and they're ahead of the game, more ahead of the game than other utilities in getting this done. Council members have taken a position on this. And you know, the ones that are there from the previous council, they've taken a position on this a lot of them campaigned on it. You know, I'm not for the privatization of JEA. They've said that. And now they're going to have to, you know, sort of stand there and understand that they will have to be convinced to, you know, to do an about face and how they respond to this latest proposal.
All right. And let's one more comment and then we'll move on. Stephanie.
Well, to directly address what the caller mentioned as well, again, this is about industry factors. So what you had 20 years ago or so was the Clean Energy Act. And that was something that, you know, fundamentally changed the business. And so JEA says they've started and stopped on a few measures since then, again, running into those regulatory hurdles. So it's not to say that the last 20 years have not been financially solvent. It's just that the factors that they've been dealing with now, we're running out of options for how to cope with those.
And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable with Stephanie Brown, Mike Mendenhall, Emily Block, Charles Griggs, and myself, and your calls. Give us a call as we move on and talk about another big headline from the week. The number to join us, 549-2937. Will Duval Schools take the city to court? The city's top attorney has shut down the Duval County School Board once again. Counsel Jason Gabriel says the school board is not allowed to hire an outside attorney in their ongoing quest to put a half-cent sales tax referendum on the ballot for voters. Duval Schools say this is the only way they can raise the funds they need to shore up, repair, and improve the oldest school buildings in the state. And so let us know your thoughts about this. It's 549-2937. Do you think the school board should sue or not? Emily Block, you've been covering this. Technically, they cannot sue. Although down in Clay County, the school board there is suing their city because their Clay County Commission had a similar move, preventing the school board from putting a sales tax referendum before Clay County voters. So what's the next move for the Duval County School Board on this?
Right. So the school board is looking at seeking outside counsel. Where they've recently got hung up is that outside counsel is telling them, or general counsel is telling them, that they can't do that. But from the notes that I've received so far and people that I've talked to, it sounds like they are going to try and pursue it anyway. We don't know a lot, and they're keeping pretty tight-lipped until their next school board meeting, which they have a budget meeting on Tuesday. But when I asked the Duval school spokesman, Tracy Pierce, what was going to happen and if their meeting with general counsel essentially nullified their vote to take action, he said that they are going to... that they're going to pursue it anyway, that they're going to talk about pursuing it, and that the vote provided the path to high school. So,
okay. And what's at stake here, really? The battle lines have really been drawn on this issue because folks and players in the local power structure do not like this referendum unless there's a certain amount of funds off the top to go to charter schools. Can you talk a little bit more about that and the dynamics of this?
Absolutely. So the latest chapter in this very long novel is that school city council members have provided school board members with a list of questions they have in order to move forward. So that list right now at my count is about 94 questions long. And those questions, some of them have subsets of questions. So really, it's more than that. And they want to receive those answers from the school board and then from there have a collaborative workshop meeting in the future. Hopefully by August is what they're aiming for.
It's 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts as the Duval County School Board increasingly looks to be taking on City Hall in their push to levy more money for schools. Stephanie Brown, this is really become a dramatic situation.
It's not uncommon, but certainly not common, that you see two large government organizations, you know, at odds in such a substantial way. And, you know, it's kind of hard to understand the or grasp some of the technical things that are being quibbled about, because you do have the overall picture of when should this election be, if it should be at all, of how much funding goes for charter schools. But really, it's also just kind of a fundamental interesting question of if the city council has to approve getting this on a ballot, are they superior to the independently elected school board? Is the school board, you know, limited in their actions? So it's created kind of an interesting just governmental subset of inquiry here.
And Mike Mendenhall, let's talk about this, because under the city's charter, the city's lead attorney, Jason Gabriel, due to some quirks in the way that the charter is written, has really wide latitude to decide what the school board can or can't do. And that begs the question, critics of his move have said that he's kicked the legs out from under the school board. They are independently elected officials. And, this is something that we haven't really seen before in Jacksonville. In the past, the city would basically leave the school board alone and sign off immediately on whatever they wanted to do. This is new territory.
Yeah. And so Jason Gabriel's interpreted the charter to say that, you know, that the school board cannot hire the outside counsel to challenge his opinion on the matter. Now, he did address the city council this week in a pre-agenda meeting prior to the full meeting and said that he would be actually putting forth offer a resolution that would allow the attorney general to weigh in on his opinion.
The Florida attorney general.
The Florida attorney general. That's right. And in the same meeting, actually, Jason Gabriel's appointment was up for renewal. That was actually pulled from the consent agenda for the city council and voted on. He was reappointed unanimously. So, I mean, they're definitely putting are taking sides.
Well, going off of that, he said, sorry, Charles. He said that Jason Gabriel said that he would have a legally binding opinion by August 13th, which is something the school board is already taking issue with. They had simultaneous meetings that day. The school board was meeting at the same time that Jason Gabriel was speaking to city council. And the school board, or Warren Jones specifically, Vice Chair Warren Jones, was saying, well, why is it happening on August 13th? That's the same day as the next city council meeting, that this will continue to get pushed back.
Yeah, the timing of everything has been problematic for the school board, because it's not allowing them to potentially take steps to move forward. You know, their goal, of course, is to get this on the ballot in November, and with these obstacles in place, they're having a difficult time getting there while they're trying to work with the city council, and the council is trying to work with them as well. So one of the problems in timing was the fact that Jason Gabriel offered a memo versus a binding opinion. And some people believe that they should have been told at that time that this was only a memo and not a binding opinion. They would have asked for a binding opinion, you know, earlier, sure. so they can get that expedited, and then they wouldn't be in this position where they could, you know, where they would have to kick the can down, or maybe be not have an opportunity to get council to vote in August so they can get it on the ballot in November.
And tying together the two big stories we've been talking about today, controversy over selling JEA, possibly controversy over how we fund school construction and repair, the threads all tie back to this current mayoral administration. He has taken a different path than his predecessors on these hot button issues. Critics have called his administration overbearing, even bullying. Supporters say he's not afraid to break things and make radical changes. And so Mike Mendenhall, you know, as we talk about this issue now of schools, and educators and parents are saying, look, you know, we've got to be able to at least have functioning air conditioning in schools. We've got to be able to not have crumbling buildings for our students. That's the emotional tug of this. At the same time that charter school supporters and donors, which are closely aligned with this mayor, Mayor Curry, have said it's time that charter schools get a bigger piece of the financial pie. Can you break that down a little bit?
Yeah. So there's been a lot of there's been a lot of ambiguity from most of the elected officials as to tying this particular vote to charter schools. I know that City Councilmember Rory Diamond actually came out during the debate recently and finally did say, you know, that he wouldn't support a referendum on the half cent sales tax unless it provided some funding for charter schools. Now the mayor's office itself is he's stated that. That he, if the school district, you know, met his requirements, would actually put his political team behind it and actually try to sell it to the voters to get it on the ballot in 2020. So it really is just trying to push this issue off a little bit further.
Yeah, see, the thing is that the people don't really need what board members are saying is that they believe they have the momentum from the public to get this referendum passed as it is now. The problem is getting it on the ballot, and that's what people are asking for. They believe that the council is holding them up in that respect and letting the people decide whether or not it should be passed in the way it is. And the other thing is, whether they take a vote or not, they've all taken positions on education. Now, all 19 council members will have a record on education, which they'll have to deal with down the road.
Emily Block.
Right. I mean, this is going off of the fact that the question, if this is even in their purview, school board members are saying it isn't. School board members are saying that council members are holding this hostage, holding the referendum hostage, holding families hostage from providing AC for their children and things of that nature. City council members are saying it's part of their fiduciary responsibility to go through 94 plus questions, whereas school board members are saying, well, no, you just have to vote yes or no and then move it on from there.
Okay, let's move on and talk about another story from the week. It's 549-2937 to join us. Mike Mendenhall, as you are reporting in the Jax Daily Record, demolition fencing will go up early next month at the Jacksonville Landing. The fencing is going up the week of August 5th. And shortly after that, the wrecking ball will take down this downtown icon.
Yeah, so the Department of Public Works issued a notice to proceed to the demolition company that's going to be taking down the Jacksonville Landing, and that'll actually allow them to start site work by August 2nd. And they've stated that they're going to start putting fencing up around August 5th, pending an approval by the Department of Public Works. Before the wrecking ball can actually, you know, get over there, though, they're actually going to have to do a hazardous materials survey of the landing to ensure that there's no asbestos, other hazardous materials that need to be removed. So we won't necessarily see it coming down immediately. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the issue, too, that there's still one remaining tenant. BBVA Bank is still there. So they're actually going to have to phase the demolition. They're going to start on the buildings closer to the St. John's River and then move so they can operate until October 28th when they're supposed to be out.
Okay. Stephanie Brown, like the other issues we've been talking about this hour, this was another one that was controversial with the public. There were those that supported demolition and others that said you could adaptively reuse this building. You could find another way to make it viable again.
And so one of the things we'll probably see from that environmental assessment is maybe a little bit more about the condition of the building, some of the things that, you know, we would have had to rectify or overcome. You know, it's an old building. It's a large building. And while there were general concepts of people who wanted to save it and for the community impact and just the iconic status, the overall question is, could whatever you convert it into be better than what you could get if you start from scratch, mm-hmm. you know? And I think the reason that it's still fixated on that is because we still don't exactly know what we will be getting. And so we'll have to see, you know, in the coming weeks and months, as we do get a better picture of what the city wants to do with that site.
Right. And the city has said they'd like green space there. People that are in favor of that think, good, that'll be beautiful. Critics have said it will attract homeless people. It will not be, in their minds, the best option for better development of the urban core. Charles.
Yeah, usually when you have something being demolished, you know what the future of it's going to be. And because we're not sure about what the future of that property is going to be, what the development's going to be, you know, some people are concerned about what's going to come next. And I've even had some folks to say kind of critically, if the council maybe would have applied the type of scrutiny to the landing property they have to the school board decision, the referendum, then we would know already what's going to be there.
But I think, go ahead.
It's not unprecedented. And it's interesting to me that, you know, for as much criticism as you have for the landing because of the iconic status, just a few blocks away, you have the demolition of the old courthouse and annex building. And there's no clear vision for what's going to happen on that site either. Similarly, along the riverfront, along the North Bank, the difference is that wasn't quite an iconic building. Mm-hmm. That was mm-hmm. an old building that was used for practical purposes. So it's, you know, there are a lot of similarities between the two sites, but, you know, just the difference of, well, what picture are you going to use at the on the promo material now for the city?
Yeah,
city hall there's lots of empty lots. That's not a good look. And so that does put more pressure on the city to come up with a plan for these parcels.
And that city hall building sat empty for a long time. So people were looking forward to it coming down.
It reminds me of that. I saw a satirical article that was like, here, 8 patches of land in Jacksonville you can hang out on. And it was and the landing was the time peg for that. So that's what it makes me think of.
Now, the city will tell you, look, you know, we do have interested parties that are looking to develop these properties, these now vacant properties. Mike.
Yeah, the Downtown Investment Authority actually is going to start to move relatively quickly on the courthouse and former courthouse and city hall properties. Lori Boyer, who's the new CEO over at DIA, told me last week that they intend to have to start soliciting bids for that property by October. So, I mean, very shortly, we'll start to see what happens with those properties. The Jacksonville Landing would be a little later, following demolition, likely in the early part of 2020.
We're continuing to get calls and emails about everything we've been talking about today on the show. Here is an email from Bruce. He tried to call in earlier. He's a former JEA employee, he says. And he writes, all utilities are facing declining electric revenues. JEA has known about this for 10 years. There are numerous alternatives to address this. I did strategic planning and forecasting at JEA. This is all part of their IRP process. The approach taken by the current board is only one alternative. For example, layoffs can be avoided by right-sizing using the 5% attrition rate. JEA has done this before. Thanks for that, Bruce. And Willie is on the line from Murray Hill. Willie, you wanted to talk about the school issue, didn't you? Good morning.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Good morning. I'm looking at this thing. Good morning, panel. Looking at this thing, is it the holdup? Could it be, hypothetically, this is how I see it, that since Jacksonville voted blue or is becoming more blue and we have a Republican administration in the office, could it be a power struggle that who's in charge? You know, like, you know, the Republicans are in charge. And another thing is, I think most of the public schools are African-American or poor white kids. This is just my hypothesis. And the charter schools are more kids who are, you know, well, more economically, you know, conducive to them. Could that be the problem, you know, because it's a power struggle, especially with Mr. Curry supporting Mr. Trump. He might have, you know, a Trump-like attitude.
All right, Willie, thanks for all of your comments. Let's talk about the school funding issue through the context of race. The school board specifically is trying to get more money, Charles, to schools in underserved and poorer and majority African-American neighborhoods because they're crumbling.
Yeah.
And he is correct in when he says that some of the charters that would benefit from this funding are not as racially diverse, although not all of them. But what about that?
Well, absolutely. The perception is that the holdup on this, one of the barriers behind this is that it almost immediately puts money into addressing long-term deficiencies in schools within the urban core and schools that predominantly serve African-American students. And with that being said, the question around the charter schools being involved in the money is the fact that charter schools are business. And they have an opportunity around their business model to choose and select buildings and properties and facilities that meet the needs of what their business model says. And in the cases where in the public schools, these schools have long gone with unmet needs. The question that people haven't been asking is how come money hasn't been coming from the state to fund them at an appropriate level? None of the questions that I reviewed addressed those issues from the council, which would have been almost appropriate, which was some of the people from the community have been saying, how come with all of this zest and zeal to review some of this information, why aren't we asking for more support from the state?
And full disclosure, let's talk about the Charter Revision Commission, which is going to be looking at a number of issues around the city's charter, as it does every 10 years. You have a role in that.
I do have a role. I'll be on the Charter Revision Commission. The first orientation meeting is this Wednesday coming up next week. So I'm looking forward to that, and we'll see what happens.
And do you anticipate a discussion about looking to have, say, an appointed rather than an elected school board, or adding another school board member, going along with all of what we've been discussing in terms of a power struggle between opposing forces in this city over how we deal with education?
You know, that's a good question, Melissa. I've been asked around in the community, and I have folks ask me, what do I think is going to happen? And I would imagine that some of the hot button topics will come up, looking at the way JEA operates, looking at the way the school board operates, looking at, term limits and things like that. I would imagine some of those ideas will be. But my thought process in the beginning when I was asked to do this was that I looked back at what happened the last time, 10 years ago, and none of the recommendations were adopted by city council. So really, after you do all the work.
Right, they put forth a bunch of recommendations, and almost none of them came to pass.
That's right. So, I'm looking forward to the work and getting to know more about what the community needs are. But at the same time, at the end of the day, it's up to city council to approve what comes out of there.
That's right. And let's make note of another important story from the week, actually happening today. Vice President Mike Pence is coming to town, and this time he's bringing along with him Ivanka Trump. They are going to make appearances at both Operation New Hope and Miller Electric. This is the VP's third trip to Jacksonville this year. Stephanie Brown, giving you an idea of how important Florida is to President Trump's reelection bid, and in particular, how much they seem to be focusing on Jacksonville. What are your thoughts about that?
I think it's been a little bit more of a cusp than would have widely been believed. And so, you know, it's not a small amount of voters. It's not a small amount of influence. You have a lot of, you know, key Republican Party players that are in this area. So to not have a firm hold of Duval County is to have a weakness in this state that, you know, neither the local, state, nor national party would want to admit. So it's not a surprise to see him here, especially focusing once again on business, you know, something that the vast majority of people foreseeably can rally around, you know, improving small business. Obviously, the opinions on how to get there are going to differ.
Right.
And I think, you know, bringing along Ivanka Trump, she's a very popular personality and somebody that could arguably bring in, you know, an even wider stop set of voters. You know, so it's not necessarily surprising to see so many trips. And I would bet money that it's not the last we'll see either.
Right. The president, to win re-election, he has to win Florida's electoral votes. Of course, we don't know who the Democratic nominee will be yet, but we are going to be treated to a lot of visits from whoever that is as well. And the candidates as they go through the primary, Mike Mendenhall.
Yeah. So my home state of Iowa is just getting bombarded right now by by Democratic
sure.
candidates. Talked to many reporters back there who have talked to sometimes three in a week. So you know, when you're talking about if you look at Vice President Pence and Ivanka Trump's locations today, I mean, it's not a surprise, you know, Miller Electric. I mean, they really, you know, with some of the more negative attention recently on the Mueller report, they really want to focus on this, talking about the strength of the economy. And the U.S. economy is very strong right now. And any incumbent president would want to push that.
Yeah. OK. And before we wrap this up, let's do a quick lightning round. What other stories caught your eye this week? Stephanie.
I've been doing a deep dive into the city budget proposal and nestled in the capital improvements.
How exciting.
You know, it's my favorite time of year. I get a little heat for that. I will say so far, I've done a story, $2 million more going to Liberty Street Coastline Drive 4.5 years after that collapse. They're now set to go over their $31 million budget. So that's going to be something that comes with this proposal.
And that was a long time coming.
Yeah.
Mike.
Yeah, so I'm actually I'm kind of waiting until next week right now. I've got on Wednesday there the city the bids close for the former National Guard armory on the north side of downtown. I'm really curious to see who's gonna propose buying that.
Charles,
well, there's been some reporting on the homicide rate from a year ago is up from this time last year, so we're gonna keep an eye on that.
Emily.
A couple of things. First, I think it's interesting that while Vice President Pence and Ivanka Trump are here, there's an almost life-size replica of the wall Donald Trump wants to build in MoCA right now, in the atrium. There's an exhibit right now about refugee camps.
And it's highlighting refugees,
and it's, yeah,
yes.
And it's actually only, I learned this last week, it's 10 feet shy of the actual model of the wall.
Wow, yeah, go see that. And last but not least, it's our look at the bizarre, strange, and ridiculous from the week. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. The Wild Turkey Edition. Yes, here in Florida, we know everything here is trying to kill us, from hurricanes to gators to flesh-eating bacteria, but now we have to also be afraid of wild turkeys. The Palm Beach Post reports wild turkeys are terrorizing a senior community in Zephyr Hills. They are charging up on them when they're out using their walkers. They're cornering them in their garage. One old man broke his hip. Florida Fish and Wildlife has visited the area twice, and they say you need to haze the turkeys. That means chasing them, clapping your hands at them, opening a large umbrella at them, yelling at the turkeys.
Or basting them.
I feel so bad for these people in Zephyr Hills trying to enjoy their retirement, but these turkeys just will not leave them alone.
You know, I walk my dog all the time, and I've been hissed at by many a duck. So I can only imagine if that beak was a little sharper and they're coming at me.
Hey, Stephanie Brown, look out for her. And thanks to everybody for being here. We'll be right back.
Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features apartments and homes surrounded by lakes and walking trails, minutes from the beach and adjacent to Mayo Clinic. 901-4222. More at lifecare.brookdale.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. A mini stroke, or TIA, happens when blood is briefly blocked from the brain. It often warns of a looming stroke and requires immediate medical attention.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
On the next Fresh Air.
Who is the girl?
greatest.
We are the greatest.
Assured.
Yeah.
Positive.
Yeah.
Definitive.
Yeah. All right. All right.
We'll hear from three members of the band Ranky Tanky. They perform contemporary versions of songs from the Gullah tradition of the Georgia and South Carolina Sea Islands. We'll hear them perform in our studio. They have a new album. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Are you a fluent texter, eloquent with your emoji? Do you spend time picking just the right meme for your message? I'm Molly Webster. This week on Science Friday, we'll look at how online communication has changed the way we write. Plus, I scream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream science. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Remember 12 years to save the planet? Scientists now say it's more like 18 months. Modi cast doubt on Trump's offer to mediate over Kashmir, and Britain has a new leader. Will his past come back to haunt him?
Stupefying ignorance that makes him, frankly, unfit to hold the office of President of the United States.
It's the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Finally, this hour, as we were talking about a little earlier on the show, the Jacksonville Landing is on pace to be demolished. Fencing is going up around the building next month. And of course, tenants who were at the landing have had to scramble to find new digs. One of them is the Art Center Cooperative. It's a nonprofit that has operated art galleries and studios in Jacksonville since 2005. Well, they have found a new home, and it's at the Regency Mall. President Ed Molesky is here now to tell us more. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
So you run the Art Center Cooperative, and you were one of the tenants at the landing that had to vacate.
We were. I mean, we've been downtown running galleries since 2006. And the last 4 years, we were at the landing. And in May, beginning of May, we got the vacate notice. We knew things were in trouble there. So we'd been looking around, and we had a commitment to stay downtown, but in the end we couldn't do it. The prices were just too exorbitant. They were like 10 times what we were paying at the landing.
Right. The tenants at the landing had extremely easy rents.
They did.
Which, you know, you benefited from for a long time. So it has to be sad to be moving on, I would think, in some respects.
Well, it is, but we're looking at it as an opportunity to turn a leaf and become something better. And the landing had its issues. It was old, and the visitation rate wasn't what we had hoped. And so we looked around quite a few places around town. We were even looking at and going into a city building at the Ballin Building, and nothing seemed to work out until we talked to the new real estate agent at Regency Mall. And they have a commitment that they are going to try and bring more arts and entertainment into that, rather than make it a retail-only location.
Right. And so this is part and parcel of the transformation we're seeing at the Regency Mall, which, of course, has struggled in recent years. You have moved to the Regency Mall on the east end of the mall near JCPenney, and you're setting up shop there. What's it like?
We were fortunate in that we're a cooperative of 20 artists. So when it came to the move, secondly, we also have a second location, so we could stage the move. We had everybody, all hands on deck. We moved everything, and we were fortunate enough that the people at Regency gave us permission to bring everything into that space, even though we didn't have a lease yet. And so we were able to basically get the bulk of things moved there at the beginning of June. And we worked like crazy to convert the place into a gallery. And so we opened on the 24th of June. And so we've been on our trial run for the last month. But we're doing our grand opening this Sunday.
This Sunday. People need to come out and see what you got.
They do. We're going to be open from 2 to 5. And thanks to the beneficence of one of our great artists, Cookie Davis, is being hosted or catered by Biscotti's, and there'll be music and entertainment there. And we're hoping a lot of people come out and see what this place can be. We're excited. It's a bigger place than we've had, so we're looking for artists to come out and look and say, gee, maybe we'd like to join the cooperative too. We have space for more artists to join. We'd like to get up to 30, 35 members rather than just 20 we're at now.
Sure. And you're not the only tenant from the Landing to migrate over to the Regency Mall.
We're not. Alley Cat was right down the way from us at the Landing, and she has opened up her store right next to us there now. And there were two others that were pretty serious about moving, and they're still in the investigative process.
Well, as this continues, we wish you all the best. It's exciting to see that you found a new chapter in the Art Center Cooperative. Go to their grand opening this Sunday, July 28th, from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Regency Mall on the east side of the mall. That structure is transforming with new tenants and new focus. Go check it out if you haven't been in a while. It's interesting to observe this happening. And President Ed Molesky, running the Art Center Cooperative, kudos and best of luck in the new digs.
Thanks so much. We're in Unit 430.
Okay. And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. We always value your feedback. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to tune in at noon today for our statewide show, The Florida Roundup, as we take calls from across the state on the biggest issues from the week around Florida. That's at noon. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be back Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.